from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
We have people on the left that reach out to us and say, I'm a crazy, hardcore leftist, progressive commie. I love what you're doing. I love that we can laugh about this kind of stuff together.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. And that's Kyle Mann, editor-in-chief of the Babylon Bee. We'll talk with Kyle a little later on in today's program about sight and about why humor is so powerful. First off on today's show, we talk with Dr. Justin Jackson. He is a professor of English here at Hillsdale College and also Edrie Seward Kennedy Chair in English Grammar here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Jackson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Scott.
Good to have you back. You are in charge. You are teaching a new online course, which will be available October 5th, online.hillsdale.edu. It's called The David Story, Shepherd, Father, King. And again, available October 5th. This is the second one you've done sort of in this biblical series,
yes.
Genesis first, and now the David story. So what was the motivation to develop this course around David? Why did you want to tell this story?
The college came to me earlier when we did the Genesis story, and I think the first suggestion was to do a David story. I had done one lecture for our Great Books 101. And I think in 35 minutes, I tried to do the entire David story, which that was pretty brutal. So they came back to me. The Genesis course was very successful. The viewers seemed to be okay, learning from an English professor something mm-hmm. about biblical narrative. Not deeply theological. I try to keep theology about as basic as possible. The theology I work from is, you know, there are certain commandments to do, and when you don't do them, you repent. And so we do that, and so they came to me asking about the David story, and I, with maybe the exception of a few passages from Job, a book I love dearly, and the poetry is just haunting in it, other than a few passages in Job, the David story is, I think, is just, in terms of just kind of a literary narrative, it is the crown jewel, I think, of all biblical narrative. And so we kind of tried things out with the Genesis story. Once we saw people were receptive to that, then it was time to kind of go after, try to do the David story some sort of justice, unlike, you know, a 35-minute lecture
right.
on the entire thing, to give people, you know, seven lectures on the David story, try to get to the psychological depth of David and also Saul. And when I say psychological, I don't really mean exactly what we think of as kind of like a brain condition,
mm-hmm.
but from the Greek psyche, of the soul, to try to get to the soul of David and everything that he went through.
Upcoming online course at online.hillsdale.edu, The David Story, Shepherd, Father, King. That's available October 5th. Dr. Justin Jackson is your teacher for this one. If people are somewhat familiar with the David story, it's there in the title, I suppose, Shepherd, Father, King. How would you describe or outline this story to people who might not be familiar with the arc of David in the Bible?
Yeah, so, you know, we keep mentioning David, but, you know, almost all of 1 Samuel has something to do with Saul as well. And so I cover a lot of the Saul story. I take Saul as probably the closest thing that biblical literature has to a tragic figure. He's both a very faithful man, obedient, and then mind-boggling disobedient. And so we look a lot at what Saul is doing, his rise to the kingship. We even look at, 1 and 2 Samuel, the two books that contain the David story. I also do the first two chapters of Kings that kind of finish off the story there. 1 and 2 Samuel, it comes after the time of the judges, and mm-hmm. it's Israel asking for a king, and you can see God's a little bit reluctant to give them a king. Give us a king like all the other nations.
Mm-hmm.
They want some sort of protection. They want to make their mark in this world, and so God kind of begrudgingly gives them a king in Saul. And so we take us through kind of what I think is the downfall of Saul and his and David's reconciliation at the end. And then we move to the David story proper with David's rise to the kingship. His also his, you can't call it a fall, but certainly his own personal disaster with Bathsheba and Uriah, and then the tragedy that strikes at David's entire household. It's a harrowing story.
It's somewhat common to hear David referred to as a man after God's own heart. Do you think people will come away from this course understanding that description of David?
Yeah, I think that's what 1 Samuel 13:14, right? After he's given up on Saul and he's found another one, David, a man after God's own heart. In some ways, that line has to give a lot of us hope, because you know, I think a lot of that, and it's hard for me, even when I teach the course and I catch myself, and I even explain this to the producers. Boy, when I read 1 and 2 Samuel, it's almost impossible for me not to think of David of the Psalms, and knowing where those Psalms come inside of David's narrative. And I think the man after God's own heart, we see very much in the Psalmic David, always returning to God. You know, God is his refuge and his fortress. It's always a turning back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why that kind of basic theological narrative that I try to lay out in both courses, which is there are things that one ought to do and ought not to do. And when one transgresses what one ought to be doing, then one repents. And I think that's, you know, if you were to ask me, you know, where is the heroism of David? I think it's in his repentance. I find it in the Psalmic David. I don't know if he's a hero for this reason, but it's certainly, what would I say? It kind of pulls, if he's a man after God's own heart, in some ways I can understand that, because when David has his own son Absalom betray him, and David's willing to, in some ways, I don't want to say give up his kingdom for his child, but it comes pretty darn close to giving up a kingdom for his child, and he doesn't want Absalom, you know, a traitor.
Mm-hmm.
His own son's betrayed him. And he says, you know, would that I had died in your place. And I'm always taken aback, because kind of those political questions that we often ask about a king, and you see it goes just in the back of David's mind, because this is a story about a father and a son.
Yeah.
And I think in many ways that's kind of what the seven lectures are about. It's just about fathers and children.
You say there are things you ought to do and things you ought not to do. We know David's a flawed man. What role does sin play in his life, and what should we learn from this David story? Is it this lesson of repentance that we should take away?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, for me, and maybe this is the English professor in me coming out, but I think it is one of those things where the greater the repentance, it seems to me in the Hebrew Bible, the greater the repentance, kind of the greater hero that we get.
Mm.
You know, from the Genesis story, if you know, your listeners have watched it, I take Judah as the hero of the Joseph story. And it's simply because he's the one who sold Joseph into slavery, and he turns around and he takes the new Israel's new favorite son, Benjamin, and he's willing to offer himself up for his brother and to stay in slavery, so that his father doesn't lose his beloved son. And that, to me, it's really quite stunning. So there's where you get to see that reversal. Judah kind of undoes those things that he's done. David's is, I want to say it's slightly different, because he seems to be working all the time to try to undo what he's done. And I'm thinking specifically with Uriah and Bathsheba,
mm-hmm.
And the prophet Nathan, you know, kind of laying out for him, this is the disaster that's coming. And in some ways, David curses himself, right? He says, I would pay that man back, as Nathan gives him the parable of the man with his beloved sheep, his beloved lamb. And David says, I'd pay him back fourfold. And that's pretty much what we see with David. And, and again, you know, for me, the real repentance comes from the Psalmic. What I call the Psalmic David is the David of the Psalms that are inserted into certain places inside of the narrative, ascribed to certain places.
Dr. Justin Jackson, he's professor of English and Edry Seward Kennedy Chair in English Grammar at Hillsdale College. He is also your teacher for The David Story, Shepherd, Father, King, available October 5th at online.hillsdale.edu, online.hillsdale.edu, another amazing online course from Hillsdale College. Dr. Jackson, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks, Scott.
Up next, we're joined by Kyle Mann, editor-in-chief of the humor site, The Babylon Bee. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the program. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address. You also can find old episodes there, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Kyle Mann. He is editor-in-chief of the Babylon Bee. You can also find him on Twitter at @the_Kyle_Mann. Kyle is on campus to give a lecture here on Hillsdale College's campus to our students and community members if they so choose to attend. Kyle, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I want to talk to you today about the Babylon Bee, a little about comedy. But for people who have not had the pleasure and privilege of checking out the Babylon Bee and the content that it churns out, what's the Babylon Bee? What's the purpose? What do you want to accomplish there?
Yeah, the Babylon Bee is a Christian news satire site. So that means that we write news, but we make it up, basically. And so we cover the headlines of the day through a satirical angle. We cover news, religion, politics, everyday life, just about every topic you can think of. We do it very much in a style similar to The Onion, where the headline is a self-contained joke as well as political commentary or worldview commentary, what have you. And so the whole purpose is to really cut through a lot of news discussion and make an important point or just make people laugh. A lot of our comedic value comes from the fact that we're able to surprise people because they're going through their news feed and it's all serious and dour. And then they come across something that looks like a news headline, but there's a joke and there's a twist. And it really does. That really is kind of the mind space that people are in when they're reading, when they're going through their Facebook feed or their Twitter feed. They come across something that makes them laugh. And it's like, wow, what is this? You know? So our purpose really is to, we say our purpose is to communicate truth to a post-truth culture. And humor and comedy are great ways to do that because G.K. Chesterton once said that humor can get in under the door while seriousness is still fumbling with the handle, which is kind of how we look at things. People's minds really get numb to so much news commentary and just headline after headline after headline. And it's really hard to make your point. You know, you can write a 5,000-word think piece and everybody – I've heard all these arguments for over this issue or that issue. And if you can make the point in 5 or 6 words in a really funny, cutting headline, it communicates the point much better, I think, in a lot of ways.
Tell me a little about the Bee's growth over the past 5 years or so, and to what do you attribute that other than your immense talent?
Oh, man. I think the main driver of growth for us really was that there was nobody else doing what we're doing. When we launched in March of 2016, it was right during the 2016 election, obviously. We launched with a crowd that was primarily Christian and conservative, and there wasn't really anybody doing political satire on the scale, level, tone that we were going for. Christian comedy at the time and still today remains fairly tame and fairly safe. People like to just make their very lighthearted Bible jokes or worship leader jokes or what have you, and that's it. And we were doing those, and we still do those. But we were also sprinkling in this commentary that was communicating a worldview, and people were going, wow, like, this is comedy that doesn't hate me as a conservative. You know, we made fun of conservatives. We still make fun of conservatives. We made fun of Republicans. But we weren't afraid to make fun of the left as well. We weren't afraid to make fun of Democrats. And when we did make fun of Republicans or conservatives, it was obvious that it was coming from this place of respect where we understood it. You know, we were conservatives making fun of ourselves, which comes across in a very different way, in a very different tone than when a late-night show filmed in New York or Hollywood makes fun of conservatives. Mm-hmm. So it really hit this void. I think at the same time, like, Christians didn't know what to make of Donald Trump at the time. And so we would write satire that would just absolutely brutalize, like, Hillary Clinton, and then we would write something that absolutely brutalized Donald Trump, you know? And it was this – people were, like, trying to figure out where we were coming from. And I think it, and we wrote stuff that really just made fun of the whole political process and pointed out to Christians that, like, yes, we're part of this political system, but hey, this isn't the end of the world. No, whether Trump gets elected or Clinton gets elected, you know, we have this hope that goes beyond this world. So I think it was really this lightning rod that Christians mm-hmm. said, hey, there's somebody who comedy has a way of going. When you read a joke, you go, hey, somebody else believes that too. It's mm. not just me, and it
right.
makes you not feel alone. So I think that was a large part of our growth. But yeah, we've really grown. Over the past 5 years that we've been around, just explosive. You know, we were very much in just the kind of the Christian, super hardcore conservative circles for the first few months. And then as the election took off, the headlines were getting shared much more broadly. So it hasn't slowed down at all. It's been a rocket ship for the last 5 years.
Kyle Mann with us from the Babylon Bee, where he is editor-in-chief. Comedy is hard. satire, even more so. It's an art. And I make the comparison, when you look at great comedies like Airplane and The Naked Gun, the guys behind those movies set a template, and then you saw all these copies come out, which attempted to do the same thing, but were nowhere near as funny, yeah. or nowhere near as good. What do you separate a great joke or great satire from maybe an obvious point or an obvious joke?
There are so many axes along which you have to think to write a good joke. That, I mean, I write a lot of bad jokes, so, you know, it's, which is part of our process. You know, you write 100 jokes to publish one. That's just the nature of a creative writer, and especially a comedy writer. You know, I tell people, if you don't think we're funny, you know, wait till you see the jokes that we didn't publish, and then you'll see. So, I mean, a good joke, you know, people talk about the line a lot, like, where's the line? How do you know to go too far or to not, you know, whatever. And a lot of what makes a good joke, especially a good political joke, is the line, because the real struggle for a comedy writer is you do have to, you know, people say, oh, how do you know not to go over the line? But you do have to go over the line on some level, because that's what makes a joke funny, is not necessarily in terms of inappropriateness or, you know, just being really crass, but in terms of somebody needs to read it and go, ooh, you know, that it needs to hit you in this. It needs to hit you in this very specific way where you didn't expect it. You didn't see it coming. Obviously, the unexpected is a large part of comedy. And so, yeah, when somebody just copies something, like, you know, when you look at all the spoof movies that came out after Airplane and Top Secret and Naked Gun and all that, it's like, or it's, you know, even mockumentaries like Spinal Tap, you had copycats that came after that. And, I mean, it really is that they're parodying, and they become a parody of themselves,
right?
Because they're trying to copy a format, but they're not understanding what really the engine that makes it tick. So there's definitely an element there. And I say that, you know, as somebody, we're writing obviously very much in the style of The Onion. We did have to find a unique voice and mm-hmm. understand that there are different tones and styles. You know, The Onion is written from a very nihilistic perspective, where it's just deconstruct everything, see through everything, where we as Christians and conservatives, we believe that there are things that are very important that are worth fighting for, you know, so our tone comes across different. There needs to be kind of a, I think good comedy deconstructs, but also kind of implies and hints towards something greater, something that is trying to make this point that that there's this maybe eternal truth, or there's this mm-hmm. objective truth that you're pointing towards. So, and I'm probably just, you know, I don't mean to sound pretentious, but sometimes it's just funny.
We'll pause right there. Kyle Mann from the Babylon Bee. Find them at BabylonBee.com. Continue our conversation next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
All all aboard. Haas Farms is now open, and it's family night fall fun for the whole family with a kids' roller coaster, go-karts and bumper cars, pony rides, little bug playland and petting zoo, zip lines and pumpkin cannons. Jump on the Haas Express Railroad train and cruise around the orchard. Family night is every Thursday with free general admission thanks to Signorama. Haas Farms is now open for all the fall fun and food. Haas Kettle Corn, hot dogs, Moe's Pizza, plus beer and wine for the 21 and over. All haunted attractions are open every Friday and Saturday. The Field of Screams, the Sinister Workshop, and the Zombie Slayer Paintball Excursions. Come blast some zombies on the Zombie Slayer rides. Special thanks to sponsors Above Board Construction and Roofing, Redding Heating and Air, Signorama, Redding Harley-Davidson, and Only One Benji. All tickets are being sold online this year, so for complete pricing and a schedule of events, get online to HaasFarms.com. That's HaasFarms.com.
Years ago, Simpson University began with a promise to be the gateway to world service. 30 years ago, we moved to Reading with a promise to serve the North State, graduating professionals who live and serve our growing community. Building on our foundational promise to educate ministers and missionaries, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping in our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to North State with no more homeless pets.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Kyle Mann. He's the editor-in-chief of the Babylon Bee. Find them at BabylonBee.com. Kyle, have we lost a sense of humor in this country over the past decade? Are we afraid that the wrong people will see us laughing at the wrong thing?
I mean, I know that there's a sense in which we've lost our sense of humor, and it comes from... It comes from multiple sides. So, like, obviously the left has gone all in on cancel culture in a lot of ways. And, you know, they're not willing to just see something as a joke. And I frame this as 50 or 60 years ago, we conservative Christians were the ones who could not take a joke because we were very serious about ourselves. You know, my parents' generation, the generation before them, they're very serious about their values and American values, which is that's a fine thing to be serious about. Mm-hmm. But it also made them a great target for comedy because controlling the cultural center meant the comedians that were that their whole job is to deconstruct the center, they made a great target for. Mm-hmm. So now we're in this bizarre, absurd situation where the left controls the cultural center, but they also think that they're oppressed and outcast. And so they think they're on the fringes, but they're holding the center. So that makes an absolutely amazing target for comedy. So there's that, you know, in terms of the left and comedy and not being able to laugh at themselves. They're the ones without a sense of humor because they're the ones who are now very religiously zealous about their beliefs. Mm-hmm. You know, they believe that, and in a lot of ways it's because the left believes that political power is the way to create utopia on Earth. So for them, if you make fun of their political, you know, it's like if someone made fun of God in front of me, right? Made fun of the concept of the Bible or God or whatever. Now, I wouldn't take it that seriously. I could laugh at myself. But it's like, on some level, I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, but, I mean, it's true, or this is something I believe, or, you know, and that's to them. This is how you create utopia on Earth, is through my political beliefs. So for you to make fun of their political beliefs is, well, why do you hate, you know, people, or the oppressed, or the poor, or whatever? Because they really believe they're the ones who are able to do that. I mean, you also just see, in general, from the left and the right, everything is politicized. You know, the kind of beans that you eat are political now. You know, we used to be able to tell a joke that was framed in such a way, like, the CDC says this. And the joke's not we had one that was like, the CDC warns consumers that kale is still disgusting. You know, and it's a great joke. You know, it's about kale. But now people, when we repost that joke, people go, well, actually, the CDC is, controlled by the Democrats. And, right. You know. It's like, well, the joke's not about the CDC. Mm-hmm. It's a vehicle. But now all of our vehicles that we use for jokes are tainted by politics. So there is, I mean, we got to be able to laugh at ourselves. We got to be able to pull away from that extreme politicization of everything.
Not to make too much of it, I guess, but is that a potential cure for some of that? If we regain our sense of humor, if we regain the ability to laugh together, will that pull us out of some of the issues and problems we as a society are dealing with?
Yeah, again, I mean, I don't like to be too pretentious. You know, we're just guys telling jokes on the internet. But more broadly, from a cultural perspective, yes. I mean, absolutely. We have people on the left that reach out to us and say, I'm a crazy, hardcore leftist, progressive commie. I love what you're doing. I love that we can laugh about this kind of stuff together. We have, you know, we're a Christian site. We'll make jokes all the time about religion. You know, we have atheists that reach out and say, I follow everything you do. It's great. You know, I'm a paying subscriber, you know, even though you guys are Christians. And I mean, there's some truth to that. Like as conservatives, we learned long ago that, you know, to separate the art from the artist, mm-hmm. because we, you know, 95% of the entertainment we consume is written by leftists. And it's really fun to watch liberals and, you know, progressives discover this. Like, they're like, well, I guess I can separate the art from the artist. You're like, yeah, we've been doing it for decades. So, but yeah, I think there is a real sense in which, comedy unites, it disarms, you know, we'll talk to stand-up comics, on our podcast who are conservative, and they'll go and they'll do stand-up comedy. And then a few jokes in, everybody's laughing, and then they'll mention, oh, by the way, I'm a conservative, you know, and then they'll start telling jokes kind of from that angle. And it doesn't faze the crowd at all, mm-hmm. no matter if it's in Los Angeles or New York or Portland or wherever, because by that point you're all laughing together, you know, and it's like, this guy's all right. He's got a sense of humor. There is a real disarming quality to humor and comedy, I think.
Kyle Mann with us, editor-in-chief of the Babylon Bee. You can find him online on Twitter at @the_Kyle_Mann. I wanted to spend just a couple of minutes talking about the reaction to the Babylon Bee. Snopes fact-checking these humor articles. Brian Stelter at CNN saying, well, that's just a fake, it's a fake news site. Why can't even critics simply look and say, well, that's humor, that's comedy. They can't just leave it as it is.
You know, Snopes has been fact-checking us for years. And at first, I mean, it really is, it's almost a badge of honor, right? Like, you write a joke, yes. And it gets spread around as real news. I mean, in a lot of ways, that's an indictment on the target of your satire. You know, if you write a joke and people can't tell if it's the Democrats or a joke, doesn't that mean that there is, that you're bordering close to reality with your joke? Yeah, there's something really strange about it, you know? It's, what is so threatening about guys telling jokes? You know, and this is something where, you know, the left will tell the right, go build your own stuff. You know, you don't like what we're doing, go build your own stuff. So we do. We go and make a satire site. And we say, fine, we'll make our own satire site. And we do it. And they fact check us. They, you know, they try to ban us from social media. They attack us from all angles. You have, I'll talk about this some in the speech tonight, but, you know, we had an ex-CIA agent that was coming after us for spreading misinformation on the internet. You know, this girl who says she's a misinformation expert online and accused us of labeling our content as satire simply to get around Facebook's misinformation regulations, which is just bizarre. It's, it's really funny when people make that kind of accusation, like we're just guys that are sitting around in a cigar smoke filled room trying to trick people. How do we fool grandma on Facebook today? You know, and it's the it couldn't be further from the truth. Like, we sit around and go, how can we make people laugh today? Mm-hmm. And that seems dangerous. And again, you know, it's we're the one site that's written from the right. We're the one. We have, you know, there's one out there that everybody knows, and it's the Babylon Bee. We're the only ones that are writing at that pace and on that scale, and that level of recognition. We have one thing on the right that we have. We have our own thing finally, you know. And they come after it, and it's so weird. It's bizarre to me. I mean, but I think there is something threatening about it, because the emperor doesn't like being told that he has no clothes, and, you know, that's what we do a lot of the time. You know, literally, we wrote a joke that the press applauded as Biden came out in no clothes.
Right.
You know, and you point that kind of stuff out, and they don't like it. And I was willing to give them the benefit of the doubt at first. Like, I understand that some people share things as real and don't realize that it's satire. That's just a challenge of the information age.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems more and more that there is just the marked difference in the way that they treat us,
right,
than the way that they treat everybody else. When The Onion tells a joke, Snopes fact checks it, and they go, "Come on, you idiots! This is The Onion. It's, you know, you know they'll laugh at people that share The Onion as though it's real."
Yeah.
When it happens to us, it's dangerous misinformation. So,
one final question for Kyle Mann from the Babylon Bee, and it's a little inside baseball, but. When you, it's not just you, you have a team at the Babylon Bee who are writing. So in short, my question is, who decides what's funny? As editor-in-chief, do you have the final, do you have to check a box that says, yes, I agree, this is funny, and you veto a joke? How do you decide what's funny, what actually gets printed, published in the Babylon Bee?
Yeah, I am the decider. You know, so I do every joke that we publish, I bet, and thumbs up or thumbs down. It's true. I do. I write a lot of the headlines myself. I write a lot of the copy myself. I do a lot of the Photoshops myself still. We're still a relatively small organization, where a lot of the creative writing is coming from a few small, small team of powerhouse comedy writers. So, but yeah, ultimately it's all the, you know, writers are just trying to make me laugh.
Kyle Mann, editor-in-chief at the Babylon Bee. Check him out. And also, eventually, on YouTube, I imagine this lecture tonight will also be there. And on Twitter, @the_Kyle_Mann. Kyle, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we hear from Kate Batchelder Odell, an editorial writer with the Wall Street Journal, a Hillsdale alum. We'll discuss the question, is the U.S. Navy ready for war? I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, we're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns. And they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260. Or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
Have you been putting off getting your colonoscopy due to COVID restrictions? Well, there's no better time than now. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, colorectal cancer screenings have declined by 86%. And as a result, up to 10,000 more deaths are projected over the next decade. With early detection, colon cancer has a 90% survival rate, and it may even be preventable with a colonoscopy. At Reading Endoscopy Center, our number one priority is the health and safety of our patients, and our center has always been committed to maintaining strict infection control and prevention protocols. Schedule your colonoscopy today by calling us at 530-246-7000 or visiting readingendoscopy.com. Visit readingendoscopy.com.
High Noble Safe Company, formerly known as Cold Steel Safe Company at 2559 Larkspur Lane, is having a summer clearance sale. Save big on some of the highest quality safes around. High Noble Safe Company carries High Noble, Browning, and American Security, just to name a few, and features gun safes, home safes, and high security safes with stores in Redding, Roseville, and Petaluma. Delivery, moving, and repair service available. Call 530-223-5050. That's 530-223-5050. Or stop by High Noble Safe Company at 2559 Larkspur Lane.
30 years ago, Simpson University arrived in Redding with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Redding's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To find out more about Hillsdale College for prospective students, for alumni, or for friends of Hillsdale, head over to hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Kate Batchelder Odell. She's an editorial writer with the Wall Street Journal, or WSJ.com, and also a Hillsdale College graduate from the class of 2013. Kate, thanks so much for joining us.
Scott, thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
I do want to ask a few questions in a bit about your time here at Hillsdale College, but you wrote a piece in the journal a little bit ago, If War Comes, Will the U.S. Navy Be Prepared? That's a big question and one that was attempted to be answered by a report that was recently issued. What can you tell us about the answer to that question? Is the U.S. Navy ready for war?
Sure, Scott. Well, listen, one of my prime reporting interests has been on the military and the question of whether what is the focus of the U.S. Navy and what dominates the time of the people in it? What direction has it gone since the Cold War? And some of those questions, I think the public is really not largely familiar with the work the Navy is doing. It happens at sea, far away. It's a little less visible than maybe some of the other branches. So I have been reporting on those questions about is the Navy attracting and promoting and retaining people that we want if there is a war at sea at some point, which is not impossible. So that was the broader focus of this piece, which this piece was about a report that Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas, did about the surface Navy, which are ships, not submarines, and whether the surface Navy was focused on war fighting or whether it had been kind of bogged down in bureaucracy. Or he wrote about some issues with a zero defect mentality, basically being very, very concerned with minor mistakes instead of developing wisdom and discernment that you want in good officers. So his report was rather dispiriting reading, but I think really important in framing some larger conversations we're having about the Navy right now, particularly in regard to China.
You write about a concern that the same level of focus that perhaps the Navy had, say, back in the 1980s, when there was a confrontation with the Soviet Union looming, perhaps that same focus is not there in today's Navy. What's the story?
Sure. Well, I think if you talk to naval officers who served during that time frame, many of them will tell you about some of the trainings that they did at the time and how focused they were on confrontation with the Soviets. And that means, what kind of ships are you going to encounter? What kind of missiles will be on board? This type of really focused training. And the question is, how much of that is going on in today's Navy? And the answer of the report, and I think the report is based on 67-hour-long interview, so it's a really detailed look. The answer was that same focus is not permeating the Navy right now. And again, this is not a council of despair. I think this has been true of other peacetime navies and of our Navy in other peacetime eras, but there is a kind of an institutional drift, perhaps, where more administrative tasks are being added on to commanders' desks, and perhaps the type of people who stay in are a little bit more oriented towards sort of that administration. And so those are some of the questions that report tried to answer. And Scott, it's culture is a nebulous concept, right? And it's, mm-hmm. it's difficult to really measure what we're talking about. But I think that core element that I was describing about our U.S. Navy sailors learning a lot about exactly what the Chinese adversary is working on, what kind of ships they have. I'm not sure that real focus is there. And that is what the piece was really meant to try to bring a little bit of broader attention to.
Talking with Kate Batchelder Odell, her piece in the Wall Street Journal, If War Comes, Will the U.S. Navy Be Prepared? You note in your story that the report also details a deep culture of risk aversion. How does that come into play?
Sure. So I think this debate has actually been going on in the Navy for many, many years. If you read the magazine Proceedings, as I do, which is the U.S. Naval Institute's magazine, you will see pieces from the 90s and the 2000s about what I call it a zero defect mentality. And that is this idea that minor mistakes are not easily forgiven in the Navy, particularly among commanding officers who are, say, the commanding officer of a ship or of an aviation squadron. The example that gets used all the time in the Navy is that Admiral Nimitz of World War II fame put his first command on the rocks, which in the Navy is a pretty big mistake, but he was allowed to continue on his career path because his superiors recognized that he had a tremendous amount of talent. And that the question is whether that sort of institutional forgiveness is still happening, and the concern is that now these minor mistakes are fireable, and the result of that, Scott, is it creates risk aversion in how you how officers conduct themselves.
I have read a little, Kate, about the concern about the size of the Navy, the number of ships, especially in relation to what China is currently doing. How would you describe the comparison between the U.S. Navy and the Chinese Navy, and are things trending in the wrong direction?
Right, Scott. So the issue is the trend line. It's not necessarily the immediate capabilities. And I think when we talk about the size of the Navy, so China's Navy is getting larger in submarines in particular. The U.S. is still way out ahead, but the Chinese Navy does have a serial production of several classes of ships that they are building fast. So the delta has been huge over the past 10 or 15 years. And I think, there has been a long sort of center-right debate about building a 355-ship Navy, but maybe not a lot of explanation of the deeper reasons why you do need a larger Navy in addition to a more capable one. Currently, the Navy is really wearing down its carrier force with overextending them with longer deployments, delaying maintenance, which makes maintenance take a lot longer in the end. And the stress on that carrier force of aircraft carriers means that, if we needed to surge carriers in the event of a real need, we might not be able to do it. So when we talk about building a larger Navy, we want the Navy to be more capable, but there is a sense in which numbers really, really do matter. And right now, the Navy at 296 ships is really stagnant compared to the Chinese Navy that's just growing at an astonishing rate and is, on track to 400 ships and will eclipse us in a lot of major categories by 2030. So I don't think we should obsess over the size, but I do think there is really a quantity characteristic that you can't replace even with higher quality stuff, much of which we have. So that would be, like I said, the concern is really the trend line. And right now the Navy is retiring cruisers without commensurate replacements. It is not on a growth trajectory, and that won't be changed without a large sustained investment in the Navy. So that is that's the trend line, and that's what's concerning.
Talking with Kate Batchelder Odell, editorial writer with the Wall Street Journal. You can find her piece at WSJ.com. I mentioned earlier in the conversation, Kate, you are a Hillsdale College graduate from the class of 2013. How do you think that the college generally and the Dow Journalism program specifically, perhaps, helped to prepare you for life after college?
Sure. I have used this line before, but I always say that most of what I learned at Hillsdale is how much I don't know. And that has helped me immensely, and even more than any of the many good, rich, particular subjects that I learned. I was a political economy major, and the economics courses that I took in public finance were extremely helpful to writing now, as I do about a lot of economic issues at the Wall Street Journal. But like I said, more than that, it was really instilled in me a temperament of humility and an ability to see the world curiously, and taught me how to better live with other people.
Kate Batchelder Odell, editorial writer with The Wall Street Journal. You can find her work at WSJ.com. She is also a 2013 graduate of Hillsdale College. Kate, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Justin Jackson from Hillsdale's English Department, also your teacher for the new online course available October 5th on the David Story. Kyle Mann, editor-in-chief of the Babylon Bee, and Kate Batchelder Odell, editorial writer with the Wall Street Journal and Hillsdale alum. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. The assistant producer of the show is Nate Esbenshade. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Turtle Bay's fall plant sale has been extended now through the end of the year. Don't miss this chance to save big during this key season for planting perennials. The nurseries open Wednesday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Thinking about starting a new career or upskilling for the career you have right now? It's never too late to start at Shasta College. Late start classes and 8-week compressed classes are still available. Reskill for those new jobs that are emerging in Shasta County. Find out today about their veterans programs and free tuition. All of this at Shasta College. Go to shastacollege.edu.
Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Reading has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage, and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
This is RC from Tobacco and Brew with this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Today we're sharing Perez Carrillo Trilogy. This gift set is the pinnacle of years tirelessly dedicated to the perfection of cigars. Rating 95, 96, and 98 by Cigar Aficionado, these three cigars have put Ernesto Perez Carrillo at the top of the industry. Come down to the best cigar shop around, Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping in our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to an North State with no more homeless pets.
Seco Manufacturing Company presents How People Make Things at Turtle Bay now through January 9th. Explore this new and interactive exhibit where kids can learn firsthand about the tools and processes used to make objects that we see and use every day. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
The Baffle and Brew, located at 2143 Hilltop Drive, has been an integral part of our community for over 40 years. They have supported the veterans, law enforcement, fire and disaster survivors throughout this whole time. Tobacco and Brew has expanded their walk-in humidor and brought to the North State new lines of fine cigars, pipes, and tobacco products. Additionally, they are offering a pipe bar to try out new tobacco for taste and aroma. Tobacco and Brew is your one-stop shop for any tobacco product and accessories to include lighters, humidors, pouches, and more. Tobacco and Brew, 2143 Hilltop Drive.
To write well, express yourself like the common people, but think like a wise man. Aristotle.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
And I'm finally back in studio, out of quarantine and COVID-free. We are continuing our series about the pearls from the masters by talking about Aristotle, one of the oldest storytellers that we know of.
Definitely one of the oldest sets of rules in storytelling that you can find. He mostly was talking about theater, about dramas that way, because, of course, most people couldn't read in that era. So most of the communication of any kind came in the form of theater and acting and stories in that capacity.
But the same principles apply today. So we're going to take a look at some of his quotes. Obviously, they've been translated from their original language, but we will be taking a look at the quotes and analyzing them using the same questions that we went over in the How to Learn episode at the end of December.
So I have to ask, do you agree with that opener of express yourself like a commoner but think like a wise man?
Yes, because all writing needs to be understood. And who's going to be reading my writing? The common people. But I want to convey more than basic ideas in my writing.
I don't necessarily like the you have to be better than other people idea, because if you talk down to your audience, good things don't generally tend to follow that. But the separation between thoughts and words is an interesting translation to try to pull off successfully.
So one of the questions that we need to look at is whether or not we share a target audience with Aristotle. Basically, no. Entirely different culture and an entirely different time. But again, there's a little bit of truth, a little bit of knowledge that I can take even though we don't share the same target audience. So let's get into the rest of Aristotle's quotes that we have for you today. We're going to start off with one that is a good mindset when you are learning how to be a writer. It is the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it. You need to be able to take advice and suggestions and entertain those ideas. Think about it, ponder it, and if it works, use it. If it doesn't, don't. But that's the only way you can get better, is if you can entertain the thoughts that you may not necessarily agree with right off the start.
The next quote is, "The aim of art is to represent not the outward appearance of things, but their inward significance."
I feel like this is one of those where the target audience doesn't quite work for me. In my fantasy, yes, but in my mystery novels, I'm writing solely for entertainment. If you are writing with a goal to create art or literature, then yes, this absolutely applies. But if you're just writing to have some fun and entertain some people, I don't really feel like you really need to dig into the inward significance of things.
I would say this would apply to descriptions, not only location descriptions, but character descriptions. I don't care if your character has blonde hair, unless it's part of her identity because all of her family for ages back had this platinum blonde hair, and it's unique, and she has attached inward significance to said blonde hair. But yes, I agree. Art isn't as much of a factor as why you're telling the information.
So on to the next quote. Most important of all is the structure of the incidents. For tragedy is an imitation not of men, but of an action and of life. And life consists in action, and its end is a mode of action, not a quality.
Basically, what he's saying here is your character's background shouldn't just be to make him have a tragic background. It should be something that motivates his future, that changes his future. Yes, it's sad his dog died. What does that change beyond he's a sad character? How does that change his actions and his future?
I interpret this as something bad happening is not just because a person did it. There is a base for that action.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.